It is the first week of the year 2021, and this is Father Roderick to the max. Hey there, and welcome back to another episode and another year of episodes of Father Roderick to the Max, a show that I record every week for my patrons. Thank you so much for your support.
Just look at the x-rays. You see that dark spot there? Whiplash.
Whiplash? Oh no.
And this smudge here that looks like my fingerprint? No, that's trauma.
I'm going to start right away with a health update. Now, of course, worldwide, the situation is still very dire, very problematic. In the chat, I've been talking with Philip, who's from London, and he says this is so different from the first lockdown. The virus is spreading so quickly right now, and the behavior of people is so much worse than it was in March and in April during the first lockdown. People are not as careful anymore. And the results are pretty scary also for the rest of us, because the hospitals, from what I read on the news, are over capacity. The staff there, the nurses, the doctors, they are all completely overworked, and wonder how long they can keep this up. And, you know, maybe the worst is yet to come. And this virus, this variant, is now also slowly being detected in other parts of the world. In my country, it's already active. That the same is true for this South African mutation of the virus. And, of course, they have closed the borders as much as they could. Now, you can only travel to the Netherlands if you can show a COVID test that is only like 36 hours old. But we still live in a hyper-connected world, so it's a matter of time before these two variants will start to spread on a bigger scale, and who knows what that will mean for the country. I'm a little bit disheartened by the fact that so many people seem to be so careless when it comes to protecting themselves and protecting others from this virus, because you'd think that they all know at least someone who has been infected, or maybe worse, has died. And yet, when I look at the behavior of people around me in the streets, in the supermarkets, it's as if there is no virus. It's crazy. Well, yeah, people are wearing masks, but they don't keep their distance. They still have a tendency to, whenever they are in a conversation, to lower the mask. So, you know, it doesn't serve any purpose anymore. And with that kind of behavior, of course, the virus will be able to spread. We are spreading the virus. It's not something that the virus does automatically. We are a necessary part of that chain. So, gosh, I'm praying that we can get this under control, but we're still a long way from herd immunity. That's going to take months and months. And the current inoculations are taking much more time than they initially planned for. So I'm kind of worried about the months to come. This, of course, also has a huge impact on my work as a priest. Most of the parish churches are closed or only are open for a few people. Like, I've decided to continue to do masses on Sunday, and usually we have like six to ten people attending in real life, so they can keep a massive distance from each other, because the church normally can seat about 350 people. But I'm very grateful for the fact that with the stream, I can reach a couple of hundred people that can join us every week. So that's a blessing. But I don't know what I'm going to do in a few weeks' time when I have to go out and film new TV episodes. That can prove to be very tricky, even though, of course, as a member of the press, of the media, I may have, you know, a little bit more leeway when it comes to traveling, for instance. But it's going to be hard to find people to interview. It's going to be difficult to film them in an environment that feels natural. You don't want to, you know, just have one person and then completely empty streets in the background. That's not going to make very interesting TV. Plus, a lot of the, normally I tell stories about activities that people do, And a lot of these activities in the church are social activities, so taking care of the poor, you know, all that sort of stuff usually involves other people as well. All these activities now have been postponed, canceled, or you know, there's not a lot happening right now. So I'm kind of wondering what stories am I going to tell? And I used to have kind of this escape. In the sense that if I couldn't find enough topics for my TV show, I'd just go to Rome and film there, or I'd travel. And but I can't travel; we can't leave the country, and it wouldn't be wise to do so. So, but I still have 15 episodes that I have to make, and I have to somehow find a way to do it. I'm currently working on a China documentary, a 3-part documentary. Which is fun, working with material that I shot 8 years ago. It's kind of amazing to think how much time has passed since I made that journey with my mom through China. It feels like just a couple of years ago, and I was stunned to see that I filmed that in 2012. I can tell from the image quality that I filmed this a long time ago. I didn't have any experience in editing myself. I had, fortunately, thankfully, had a digital camera, but the filming is all over the place, and it's, you know, it's okay. I can work with it, but people are definitely going to notice that this is not recent camera work. So, but once I'm done with these 3 episodes, or actually even before the 3rd episode will air, I'll already have to be out there filming new stuff. And so one big advantage right now of my current situation is that apparently, so far so good, I'm doing better than a few weeks ago. I have more energy. I went out for a run this morning for the first time, and I kind of was debating with myself, is this wise? Because I'd read a lot of articles about you know, potential risks of running post-COVID. Sometimes the heart muscle can be damaged and you wouldn't know that. So in some cases they've seen arrhythmia with runners who went too fast and started running right away. Now, so I just walked for weeks and weeks and weeks. The only thing I did was to try to get 10,000 steps in every day. That was my way of still, you know, being outside, which is mentally very important, especially when you're in a lockdown. I love to be outside. I love the winter weather. I'm on the edge of the city, so I can easily walk for about 10 minutes and be out in the open and, you know, on the countryside. So it makes for a change as well, a visual change. And of course, for my stamina, it's also important to keep walking. I'm still really out of shape. I'm way too heavy. I gain a lot of weight because of the, you know, being tired all the time. So I need to kind of get rid of that. And walking is a kind of a slow way to burn calories. Running is much more efficient. So this morning when I woke up, I felt so good. And the weather was beautiful. It was this crisp weather. It had been freezing during the night. So there was the dew on the fields had frozen. So you had this kind of white layer over the fields. And the sun was getting up. And I was like, oh, this is the perfect running weather. I just want to go and run. And it was like, well, but what about the heart flutters and everything? Is this wise? I'll go slow. Okay, but only if you go really, really slow. In a moment, I was talking to myself, the moment your heart rate gets over 170, you stop immediately. You let that heart kind of slow down again. And as soon as you get dizzy or whatever, stop and you walk and you go home. Okay, promise? Yes, I promise. So I put on my running gear. I totally forgot that my training jacket that I normally wear, that the zipper had broken months ago. It's been such a long time. The last time I was running, it was still summer. And so I think the zipper broke like a year ago, and I never wore the jacket anymore. So that was a little bit annoying because it was pretty cold outside. So I had this thermo underwear, which is actually very warm and does a very good job insulating the body. But after a while, you still start to sweat. So it's nice to be able to close your jacket. But hey, I didn't have an alternative and all the stores are closed. So I just had to make do. So I started running and I was amazed. I was really amazed at how easy it was to pick up running again. I was not out of breath. I took it very slowly, but sometimes I just feel like I'm made for running. I'm built for running. This is my natural way of propelling myself. And I went very, very slowly every mile or kilometer. I always wonder what my gear is set to. I think this was kilometers. Yeah, it's set to kilometers right now. So when I train for a marathon, I always set my gear to miles because it feels easier to run, 26 miles rather than to run 42 kilometers. 42 kilometers. In miles, a marathon sounds and feels much shorter. But anyway, kilometers. Every kilometer, I would get an update how much time it took me to run a kilometer and then what my current heart rate was. And so initially it went up to 165 beats per minute. And then a little bit later, it was around 175. That's kind of the max. That is actually, that has always been for the last 2 years, kind of my maximum heart rate. So I should never go beyond that. But then I went even slower. I took some photos just to slow my heart rate down. So while I was taking photos, of course, I wasn't moving. And so it did take me about an hour to run, 5 miles, about eight kilometers or something like that. So that's very slow, but I think it was good. It was right speed. I felt great when I got home. I have a little bit of muscle aches now, but it's absolutely much better than a month ago when if I would go out for a walk and I would walk for about an hour, I would have immediate, pain in my legs the same day, which is not normal for me. Normally, you get the muscle aches the day after. So I think a month ago, my body was still completely out of whack. This feels much more like it used to when I was training. So tomorrow, of course, I'm not going to run at all. I'm still going to see how I feel, if there are no consequences health-wise. But so far, so good. Another thing that I've discovered is that the fatigue that I was experiencing was not just linked to... I think it's a result of COVID, but it was not just... not having reserves. Like a few days ago, I felt tired the entire day. I wanted to go to bed. I slept a few hours in the afternoon, and in the evening I was still tired. And then I noticed that around 10 o'clock in the evening, all of a sudden, it was as if I was waking up. And I wasn't drowsy anymore. It was almost as if I was truly awake for the first time that day. And then it struck me, what if this feels like a sugar thing, a blood sugar thing? So in the past, when I was, for instance, studying in Italy, sometimes we would eat pasta in the afternoon for lunch. You'd go to a restaurant and have a nice... pasta and then even like a main course, and then I would basically crash completely for the rest of the day and only start working again at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Of course, it was the blood sugar spiking with all that pasta, and that knocks you out. And the fact that at 10 o'clock in the evening, when the effects of dinner were gone, I was starting to feel much more energetic. I was like, well, maybe this also has to do with what I eat. And of course, since since I've been recovering, I just don't, you know, I don't spend much time cooking. I don't eat unhealthy, but I eat pasta, I eat rice, bread, all that stuff. And I know that that can cause your blood sugar to spike after a meal. So I was like, well, I have experience with a different type of diet that in the past has been doing miracles when it comes to energy. And that's keto, the ketogenic diet, where you kind of try to reduce carbohydrates to a minimum, and then focus on all the rest. And I remember when I was doing keto for a couple of months, I never felt that much energy before. Now, I stopped doing keto after a while because I didn't see I was healthy. I was feeling good. And I didn't want to. One of the reasons that I stepped away from keto was that I wanted to make sure that I also had my fiber. And it was a bit harder just being on a ketogenic diet to get enough fiber and to have a balanced meal. I'd oftentimes just be too tempted to stick with meat and some veggies. But I was like, okay, well, I need some energy right now, and I want to make sure that I'm not sabotaging my own recovery by ignoring the effects of what I eat. And so, since 2 days, I've been eating mostly a ketogenic diet, at least until the evening, and then I may sometimes add some potatoes, or like this evening, I added some brown rice. And so far, it's been amazing. The difference has been amazing. I have so much more energy. And the energy is more constant during the day. I don't have these relapses where I all of a sudden I'm so tired that I need to lay down. I still have these moments of dizziness when I run up the stairs too quickly. Or, for instance, when I fasten my shoelaces, it's very strange. You're like the blood is going to my head, and when I stand up again, I'm like, oh, I'm so dizzy. So it's not entirely normal, but I'm definitely going to stick with the ketogenic diet for a while and see if that will help me at least get through the day more easily. And maybe it will generate some more energy reserves. So my big temptation is, of course, as soon as I feel better, I start working harder and I forget to take my time of rest. And a therapist has told me that it's not just about sleep or anything. It's also about resting your mind, getting that stress out of your system. And I have a tendency to, as soon as I feel good and I have energy, I've got 1,000 ideas. And I had to really stop myself from, for instance, starting to produce new YouTube videos. I had tons of ideas like, oh, I'm going to build my YouTube channel. And this month, I've been doing very well because of that video that went viral of my reaction to the season 2 Mandalorian finale. So I was like, I need to build on that. I need to create more content. And I was like, no, don't. That has always been my trap. It's a trap. It's like spending every bit of energy that I have before I can build up reserves. And that would, again, I think, sabotage my overall progress. So what did I do instead? I did some Lego. I read some books. I just took some more time to cook. I have a very, very good overall planning in my calendar right now. I'm still, I need to tweak a few things, especially I want to go to bed a little bit earlier and waking up a bit earlier. so that I'll have a more balanced morning and afternoon. Right now, if I wake up too late, the morning is too short to get anything done. And I have vowed to not work after 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That is why I'm recording a podcast right now at 9:30 in the evening. But honestly, chatting like this doesn't feel like work. I mean, it's not total leisure, but I do enjoy this. And I like chatting with the people in the chat room. So, yeah, I think I'm on the way up. I have no idea how quickly this will continue to improve. I have another appointment with my two therapists 2 weeks from now. I deliberately wanted to take some time off during this first part of January because I knew that I had to produce my China documentary. Plus, I just wanted to have some me time. The time before the end of the year, Christmas, it's been so busy. There was so much stress because of the change in my appointment in the parish, and there's still a little bit of stress around, you know, what am I going to be able to stay here? So I wanted to take some extra time off, not have any extra appointments. So I guess in 2 weeks' time, hopefully, I can bring them some good news. And so I don't know how long this trajectory is going to take. Probably just as long as it takes, as long as it's necessary. But I'm very grateful for what I've learned so far, and especially with the addition of the note-taking, the journaling that I'm doing every day. If you want to hear more about that, of course, check out the walk and the recent regular podcast where I talk a little bit about the impact that that has had so far. I think I'm already doing much better than last year, so hopefully that's going to pay some dividends in the near future. All right, it's time to take a look at the kitchen. And I want to recommend a YouTube channel that I am following. And that has really taught me some neat tricks and some techniques in the Chinese kitchen. Now, of course, I'm all into China right now because I'm working on the footage of my journey through China. And I remember how delicious the food was every single day. There was so much diversity. The food was different every single day. And we're not used to that anymore because I cook for myself. So I often go back to my favorite recipes. Why would I not cook my favorite recipes? There's no one else here. I can just cook whatever I like to eat. But it also kind of stalls my progress in the kitchen. But now that I'm looking at my material of my footage, I just remember how good the Chinese cuisine was. And it was different. Anywhere you went, they had different ways of cooking, different techniques, different ingredients as well. So I'm following this channel called Chinese Cooking Demystified. And it's wonderful. I think it is originally a Chinese series, but they do a voiceover in English. So I'm not exactly sure who is behind the channel. There's always at the end there is this woman who in English tries to communicate and give some extra information, but you can tell that English is really not her native. Well. Obviously not her native language because she's Chinese, but she's not very comfortable in English. So maybe the cooking is also done by her, and then they just hired a voiceover. But it's very well produced. I really love the way in which they explain how to cook those dishes. And as I said, I've learned some techniques that I'm using for my own recipes. There are two recipes that I tried to make the other day. Sichuan sauce beef, sauce fried beef. I'd never heard of that technique, but it is amazing. What they also tell you is what ingredients to buy. So, and also when to add them to the dish. I have a lot of Chinese ingredients that I just buy here at the local Oriental stores. But sometimes I just throw them in a pan altogether and just hope that it'll taste good. But it turns out that there is also a sequence in which you have to. For instance, I had this Chinese wine. It's a bit like rice wine, but sweeter. And I bought it on a whim because I needed it for one particular recipe. And I don't think I even used it back then. And it's been sitting in my cupboard for a while. And I was wondering, what do I do with this? So there's this entire video about this wine, and it's actually just a kitchen variation of what is truly kind of a local delicacy, a wine that people drink at a table or during dinner. But then the version that you buy in stores apparently has more salt in it, and it's really meant for cooking. And I had no idea how to use that. So I was watching this video, and they tell you, actually, the first thing you do in Chinese cooking is you start with the aromatics. So that is garlic, pepper, you know, red pepper, onions. So all that will release its fragrance first when you put it in the oil. So that's where you always start. The moment it starts to release its fragrance, at that moment you can add the wine. And it was like, that's so funny. I would never think of adding that at this point because you want the wok to be as hot as possible. So of course, if I add wine, it's going to cool down the thing. It's going to add liquid. So is that still going to work for stir fry? Well, it turns out there is a technique. You have to add it you have to make sure that your pan is really hot. And then you pour it not in the middle of the pan, but on the sides. And what happens is that immediately, it's because you use the bigger surface of the pan, it is starting to reduce right away. And then it flows down into the pan. So the moment it reaches kind of the center of the pan, most of the liquid has already been evaporated. And what remains is the flavor. I had no idea, but it worked. I did it this evening, and I don't know exactly what it adds to the dish. It's hard to describe, but there's a bit of a sweetness to it. And then another thing that I saw in I think it was in the in that same fried beef recipe, and I think this Cantonese, they added some lemon juice at the end, like lemon juice. For real? So I didn't have lemon juice, but I used lemongrass, about like dried lemongrass. And what that adds is a little bit of a tang to the dish. It's, again, it's hardly discernible, but it does add something that I wasn't familiar with. But when you use the same ingredients, every dish tends to taste the same. But with these little tweaks, all of a sudden you're just like, wow, oh, this tastes professional. I'm getting there. So it's a ton of fun. Another thing that I want to try out, but I haven't yet, but it looks so good on the video, is Cantonese-style scrambled eggs. Now, we've all been at one point in our lives, probably in a hotel where in the morning they serve scrambled eggs, and that's usually a disaster. Because those scrambled eggs have been sitting there for about, I don't know, half an hour or something, especially in Italy. They don't know what to do with eggs in Italy. So they overcook them, and you've got this rubbery stuff sitting there, these blobs of egg, and it has nothing to do with scrambled eggs. Scrambled eggs, of course, have to be still a bit moist and have to be kind of silky. So in the U.S., they'll add cream to it. Like, well, we'll just fix it with cream, which, of course, is disastrous. It's like, you know, all the pasta dishes that you get in restaurants there where they add tons and tons of cream, and it's no. Like a carbonara with cream. That is a mortal sin. You don't go to Italian heaven if you cook like that. It is the sauce is the egg that makes the sauce, and not the cream. It's an American travesty. Anyway, apparently the same is true for these the Cantonese scrambled eggs. So they have this technique where you you use a lot of eggs. That's one of the reasons that I haven't made it yet. Because they're using like 5 or 6 eggs. And I'm thinking, if I eat 6 eggs in the morning, I'm going to have a heart attack after a week. But anyway, the technique is you separate the egg whites from the yolk. And then you stir the egg white with using chopsticks, which is another technique that I picked up on in these videos. Like, why haven't I figured that out before? Chopsticks are ideal for stirring up stuff. It's easier than a regular utensil. What's it called? Anyway, so you first stir, you whip up the egg whites until it gets really bubbly. And only then you fold in the yolks. And you don't stir those as much as you did the egg whites. What that does is it creates a very fluffy ensemble. And then, this was kind of hard to pull off. I don't know if I can do it without a wok. But what you do is you have an oiled wok that's piping hot. And then you pour in the egg. And after only like a few, like 20 seconds, of course, the bottom part of the egg starts to solidify. And what you then do is you take a spatula and you take the part that is already a little bit solid and you fold it over to the other side. And what happens is then the part of the egg that is still liquid kind of drips off, goes into the pan, and then again, after a few seconds, you fold it over, and you continue doing that. So you get this multi-layered, kind of lasagna-style scrambled egg. And the advantage of this technique... Oh, and the other thing is, you keep the pan not in the middle of the fire, but you only heat the part of the pan where you want the egg to cook. You don't want to keep cooking the part that is already solid, because then you get the rubbery egg and it doesn't work anymore. So it requires you to hold the pan halfway over the fire, and then with the other hand, you keep folding over the eggs. And because it's layered, you can see if it's got the right consistency. So before it can overcook, that's where you take it out and you plate it immediately. And then, of course, with any scrambled eggs, you have to eat it right away. That's the problem with hotels. It's been sitting there for the entire duration of the breakfast. So whatever was liquid is now overcooked. So, again, the only thing that's keeping me from doing this, I tried this with using only 2 eggs, and 2 eggs is not enough. Because it just immediately fills the entire pan, and everything starts to solidify right away. So basically had an omelet instead of scrambled eggs. But and then the other thing that they teach you in the video is to add ingredients. So you can basically combine this type of scrambled egg with, for instance, pieces of Chinese sausage, or make it with veggies, you know, some onion, spring onions, for instance, or even paprika. Bell pepper, so many different variations. And then I think another thing that they do, but I have to rewatch that video, is they add a bit of sesame oil to the egg, if I'm not mistaken, and maybe even some other herbs. I'm not sure. I was focusing more on the technique. It's like, wow, I've never seen someone make scrambled eggs like that. So that's another thing that I want to learn. And here's here's what else I've learned on the internet. I was watching some more TikTok videos, and it was a nice video. Maybe this was not on TikTok. This was on YouTube. Is this this guy who has actually a fantastic channel, or fantastic? It's all about productivity. He used to be a doctor in London, in the UK, and then he went full time on YouTube, like halfway through the last year. Now, for many people, 2020 has been very hard for them, and they sometimes lost their jobs. He deliberately stepped away from his job as a doctor and started to, you know, build up his YouTube channel. And now he is making a ton of money. He's got like 1 million followers. It's insane. But his videos are really good. And he's one of my examples when I'm thinking of growing my YouTube channel. I think this is what I should do. This is kind of where I should, what I should aim for. I'm trying to find him in my long, long list. I've got 133 subscriptions right now. So it sometimes takes a bit of time before I find the particular channel. And it doesn't, for some reason, the order is all over the place. So YouTube doesn't show me this in chronological order of subscription or in alphabetical order. So where is this guy? It's so funny, by the way, that YouTube's algorithm is very short of memory. I've noticed that it immediately reacts to whatever video I've watched just a day or 2 days ago, and it will completely rearrange my entire front page based on those two or three videos. And so a lot of the channels that I'm subscribed to don't show up anymore. And I'm browsing through this entire list of subscriptions, and almost none of these ever show up on my front page, which is kind of frustrating for YouTubers, because you can even if you have so many subscribers, it doesn't mean that they will all be there for you. Well, I can't find it. That is annoying. I'm sure I'm subscribed to him, but he's got a kind of a peculiar name that's hard to remember. Oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go to my history. Smart. That's my reaction to The Mandalorian. Playing the background automatically. Here we go. I do that sometimes with browsing as well. I've been to this website and I can't find it anymore. I forgot to bookmark it. I was like, oh, I've got my history. That makes it really easy to find those forgotten websites. Okay, I've been watching a lot of YouTube lately. I'm almost ashamed when I see this. Okay. I found the video. It's not by the guy that I thought it was made by. This video... it's by Thomas Frank, and it's a production. It's about productivity. Here you go. So his name is Ali Abdal.
55 and like 60.
There you go. And he's got 1.3 million subscribers. That's insane. And he does all his videos are very well prepared. It's not very, you know, the production value is not that good. It's okay. It looks fine.
Hey guys, welcome back to the channel.
But, he's not making documentaries or anything. But I think that his content is just apparently very valuable to people. He talks a lot about how to create like passive income streams, which is, of course, interesting to a lot of people, because you would like to, you know, sleep and grow rich. So he talks a lot about how he did it. Which makes it, I think, more convincing, because he's telling you about stuff that he tried out, things that work, things that don't work. But he also gives you a really step-by-step tutorial oftentimes. So just to name a few of the topics that he's posting about, how I type really fast, 156 words per minute. That is bloody fast. I mean, I type fast, but not that fast. How to make money from your passion. So that's all about, you know, creating new income streams, how to stop procrastinating, a day in the life as a doctor. So he was still working at the hospital back then. And I think when he was still working as a doctor, he had like 300,000 viewers. And then when he stopped and dedicated himself full-time to YouTube, he went he grew his channel in a few months to 3 million. He's got my failures, rejections, and lessons learned, how I remember everything I read, how to get started with investing, the 5 key principles of productivity. There is nothing that unique in what he does. He's a good teacher. I have to give him that. He has a very calm voice. He's a natural on camera. That helps too. So a month ago, he had 1 million subscribers. Just to show you how this algorithm works. A month ago, 1 million subscribers. He got the plaque, you know, from YouTube. Okay, and now he's got 1.3. I thought he had 3 million subscribers. Like, how can you get 2 million subscribers in just a few months? But 1.3, still, that is a 30% increase in just a few months. It's insane. He gained more subscribers in the past 3 months than I have in total. It's, wow. I need to learn how to do this. Not because I want to be like a YouTube celebrity, but this could be a substantial source of income that won't really cost me that much in terms of work. Producing YouTube videos, even if you do it as well as he does, still is nothing compared to the work I have to put into my TV shows. So I'm really thinking of you know, building this YouTube channel up, but I'd probably have to make some hard choices on what I'm going to focus on, because I can tell from my statistics what works and what doesn't work. And there's a lot of things that I like, but not all of that is going to grow my channel. And actually, if you put too much different stuff, if your channel is about everything, it's about nothing and you won't grow your audience. That is why I've restarted my Lego YouTube channel, and it's only going to be Lego. I'm going to see how quickly I can grow that channel if I focus only on Lego. So it's going to be Lego live builds. Maybe I'll do some Lego animation, because that is very popular and it's fun to make. Very time consuming, but also very rewarding, because these videos can be used for many years. So I'm going to try that out. See if I can grow that to, like, right now I've got like 350 subscribers, which is not bad for only 4 videos on that channel. But I know how to play the game. I know how to tag. I know how the algorithm works, more or less. So that'll be a nice test case to see if a very niche-focused YouTube channel can get traction. I'm pretty sure it can, because the competition, if I'm honest, there are a lot of Lego channels out there, but most of them have super low production value. Yes, these guys build Lego all the time and they show their huge collection, but it's not always fun to watch, because it's not, I see people with like 500,000 followers and they're filming everything with a webcam. I'm like, I can do better. I can certainly do better. Anyway, but for the main YouTube channel, of course, I'm using it for Star Wars, for reaction videos. I'm using it for these podcasts that I stream live. And that is terrible content. I hardly get any views on those, of course. It's fun when you're in the chat room and you watch me record a podcast, but it has no lasting value, because my podcasts are about everything and nothing. So one of the things that I've been adding in the two recent streams is I add chapters and I make a list of things that I talk about, but it's still not specific enough, I think, for the channel to really start growing. My guess, if I look carefully at what my audience likes the most, it's very surprising. It is the masses. I get a lot of traction on the mass. Well, actually, no, I get a lot of engagement. So I get a lot of high quality engagement on the live masses on Sunday. And it also grows the subscriptions, strangely enough. But it's nothing compared to the numbers that I get on reaction videos. And any other type of video that I make, like commentary, sometimes I, you know, spend time. Like last year, I did this entire, like, episode by episode commentary on The Mandalorian. It took me so much time to make those episodes, like a day per video of 10 minutes. And it didn't do much. Yes, I got a couple of thousand views, but I expected way more. But what always works, and oftentimes even goes viral, are these reaction videos. So apparently there is something that keeps people coming back because they want to know my reaction to stuff. And the more spontaneous it is, the better it is. So I think that is what I should focus on. And if I do it well, it could also benefit, I think, the growth, the other side, because I got quite a few people that discover that I'm also doing these live streams on Sunday, and then they, you know, even though they are declared atheists, they still want to, you know, kind of peek around the corner and see what this guy is doing on Sunday, and they're like, that's actually not that bad. So anyway, the sandwich formula in a certain way. You mix your content. I'm still not entirely sure that mixing these two completely different types of content, like the mass plus reaction videos, is going to do it in the future. But so far, so good. The question, of course, I have to ask myself, I'm on a tangent here. This is not at all the segment I was supposed to tell you what I learned. But this is something I learned. This is part of my learning process. So I share it with you anyway. The question I ask myself, is this what you want to do? How does this add value to the lives of the people that follow you? Because if it doesn't have value, then it may be profitable to do that. It may result in growth of the channel. But ultimately, what is it worth? Now, I do know from reactions, unfortunately, people usually are very generous with their comments. What people seem to like about my reaction videos is the positivity. Is this, like, I'm not a cynical person. I'm not poo-pooing everything that Lucasfilm does or anything. So they see someone who it can get genuinely excited about stuff. And apparently that is rare, relatively rare. And so they want more. It gives them a good feeling that I have a good feeling. It's contagious. Joy is contagious. So I'm thinking, well, that's something I can live with. If I can bring some joy in the lives of the people that follow me, and then maybe at a certain stage they want to know what's the secret of this joy, where does this come from, what else has he got to say, then maybe, you know, I can branch off some other content. Maybe that's the formula. But in order to do that well, of course, I need to record way more reaction videos, which, by the way, actually not hard to do. You just sit down in front of a webcam and you play a video on your screen, and I'm just me, and that's what you get. And, well, it's as easy as that. Sometimes I spend hours and hours and hours on a very scripted, well-prepared video, and it does nothing. And then I just flip on a camera and start recording myself, and, you know, it's like 3 minutes work, and you've got 50,000 views. Or even with the Mandalorian reaction video, that was not even filmed by me. That was filmed by Hank. And he just used a crappy old iPhone. I think it's the iPhone 5 or something like that. The image is super grainy. There was almost no light in that room. He's not a cameraman, so. But it's still got 50,000, or what is it right now? Maybe not 50,000, but it's got a ton of views. Let me just go to my main channel here and see what the score is right now. So that video alone has resulted in $160 of pure revenue from that one month. It's received 64,000 views. 64,000 views, and it's filmed with Like a 5-year-old phone. I'm crazy to work in television, actually. I spend 90% of my time working my behind off to produce old-fashioned television. And they give me like a few coins. Let's throw a few coins to the Witcher. Whereas the stuff that is no work whatsoever has so much more impact. 60,000 people. I have TV shows on national TV that don't get these numbers. Like sometimes there are 40,000 people or 20,000 people watching a TV episode that I worked like a week on, day and night. There is a lesson to be learned. I'm pretty convinced. Okay, so what was the thing that I actually wanted to share with you before I got on this soapbox? It's a video by Thomas Frank called Perfectionism is Destroying Your Productivity. And he basically says there are a lot of people that are creative, but also have a tendency to only publish what is, according to them, perfect. And they spend way too much time preparing, over-preparing. Well, actually, this was an important thing for me to hear. A lot of the times I don't post reaction videos because I feel, I don't have the proper lights. I'm too tired. I'm not going to be excited enough. I don't know what to expect, so I don't know what to say. And I overthink it. And then nothing gets recorded and nothing gets out there. Basically, his video has one big recommendation, and it's just go, do it, make it. You'll get better while doing it. And even things that are not perfect can still be super effective. And, well, the Mandalorian reaction is one of those things. It has so many flaws, and yet it works. It's what people want to see. I also see it on TikTok, where people go viral, and it's filmed without any technical quality. It is just a selfie camera on their phone. Like the background is blurry. They move their phone around. But it's all about. It's what they have to show. It's what they bring to the table, and even the fact that it is not professional seems to work to its advantage. Now, I don't think it's going to stay like that because with vlogging, we had that same first wave of vloggers that would film everything. You know, their vlogs basically would be, hey, I just woke up. I'm using my phone to film myself while I'm super tired. And now I'm going to make coffee and I'm going to film that. And here's my hamster. And that would be vlogs. And, well, people watched that because it was refreshing to see something that was real or at least felt real. Nowadays, you wouldn't get away with that. Nowadays, a lot of these vloggers, the ones that are getting traction, have very well-produced stuff. They use drones, editing. It's amazing cameras. So over time, quality always wins. That's why I'm not going to just give up on my TV work, because that's where I learn how to do, you know, quality that lasts. But at the same time, perfectionism can also completely sabotage the amount of production, and it can rob you from good content. So I'm going to try this year to do more spontaneous stuff. Actually, what I do when I preach, when you hear a homily, rarely has it been prepared. It's usually off the cuff. These podcasts, yes, I have like, how many bullet points do I have for this show? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I'm now at bullet point 3. And yet I've been talking for 53 minutes. Do you think that I would ever script a show like this? No. It is the spontaneous nature of this, the kind of the conversational style, that is what works for me and apparently also for you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this. So why do I throw away this experience that I have speaking off the cuff and being spontaneous whenever I post something on YouTube? So I'm going to try to force myself to be more spontaneous. Anyway, wow, that was long. I'm going to skip the comic book segment. Oh, no, I'm going to do it because I've got something to review.
I'm quite keen on comic books, especially the ones about superheroes. I find the whole mythology surrounding superheroes fascinate.
You ever try these comics?
No.
You know something?
No, what?
You read too many comic books.
I'm going to give you a review of The Rise of Kylo Ren. This is a canon story that is part of the comic book storytelling of Disney or slash Lucasfilm. And since, of course, Disney also owns Marvel, it's part of the lineup in the Marvel Unlimited app. I have a Marvel Unlimited subscription for now. I'm not sure if I'm going to keep paying for that because it's pretty expensive and I actually don't use it that much. But I was interested in The Rise of Kylo Ren because apparently, since it's canon, I was interested in to see how did this boy actually grow up and become this evil, this pupil of the dark side, and what was his relationship in the past with Snoke, etc. Well, this story gives you a little bit of background. So you see a younger Snoke, who still looks pretty terrible, but he's wearing some kind of weird hat. And then he's training. You see him training a younger Kylo Ren, but it turns out that Kylo Ren has already been communicating, at least through his inner voice, with Snoke, even while Kylo Ren was still training with Luke Skywalker. And then you also see some other students that are pupils of this Jedi school that Luke Skywalker created. And then you see kind of the aftermath where, Luke has attacked Kylo, of course, and then Kylo walks over to the dark side, gets really embraced by Snoke and more in the clutches of Snoke. And then there's some stuff happening. But what makes it interesting is that he meets the Knights of Ren. And we discover why they are called the Knights of Ren. And it was interesting. I certainly appreciate the information because it never really made sense. That an entire, Knights of Ren felt a bit rushed and something they put into movies without really justifying it, and I did not appreciate that. I wanted to see more of that, or at least have a little bit more background story. You can't just drop like a mysterious looking group of samurai warriors and not explain anything about it. It's kind of the same problem with Snoke. He's not introduced at all. You don't get much information, so it feels a bit random. So the comic book gives you a bit more information about why these guys are called Knights of Kylo Ren Knights of Ren and how Kylo became their leader. I was not convinced by that story. I did not think that they did a good job. It feels like a really throwaway episode. It's just not good storytelling. I'm sorry. It feels like this more like a standalone Star Trek episode. So I was like, wow, that's all? That's Ren? These are the Knights of Kylo Ren? I don't know. It just doesn't work. And maybe it's because it's in comic book form. And also Snoke, I don't know. I just visually, doesn't work for me. Now that I've read it, I wish they would have kept this for a movie later on, or even a TV show. How cool would that be? A TV show about the Knights of Ren, and then see Kylo running this group of samurais. Could have been really cool, but the comic book doesn't do it justice. It was a bit of a downer. I expected way more. It is, graphically it's well done, but it didn't work for me. What do you do? I'm going to wrap things up with some liturgy secrets, and I want to talk a bit about sacristy rituals. The other day I found a video on YouTube in which a priest was explaining Mass. That was the title of the series. You see this older priest who kind of comes across as a bit of a kind of a grumpy old man. He filmed this with a younger, maybe a seminarian, or maybe it's one of his parishioners, this younger guy who is filming him, and he is just explaining the vestments and everything. It's well-intentioned, but I was like, he's kind of the prototype, kind of rigid priest who's very much about all the little minute details, a lot about the form, and I don't know, it felt it's very pious, very devout, but it also feels a bit, I don't know, a bit empty. I know a lot of these, of priests like him, where I'm thinking, well, but the priesthood is about so much more. Even liturgy is about more than that. It's not just about form. It's not just about ritual prayers. I just missed the heart. Maybe it's there, but I couldn't relate to it at all. I was like, okay, I'm also a priest. I also prepare for Mass. But the way this spirituality, absolutely from another planet for me. So he was explaining the way you prepare for Mass, the various prayers that go with the vestments. And while he's explaining it, I'm thinking, well, you know what? That is all no longer part of the current rituals. These are rites that were used with the old liturgy before the liturgical reforms. Nowadays, we don't pray those prayers anymore. Now, if that is a good thing or not, that remains to be seen. There is one thing that I kind of appreciated, is that the entire rite of clothing yourself, so you've got all sorts of different vestments, and every vestment in the old rite had a prayer that you needed to do. So for instance, you have this rope around your waist, and while you're tying it around your waist, you're supposed to pray this prayer for chastity, but just this entire prayer was like, who talks like that? Who prays like that? I mean, it's so old-fashioned and like other planet for me. On the other hand, I like the idea. We should bring back these prayers, but make them new again. Just kind of update them a little bit. Make them also more biblical. Because the issue that I had with these old prayers is they're very, very devout, very pious. But that's it. It's just kind of an old-fashioned form of piety that I think a lot of younger people cannot relate to anymore. I can't. I absolutely can't. And I'm pretty, you know, Orthodox priest, but it's so not the way I talk to God. It's not the way I pray. It's not the language that we use anymore. And what I missed is the biblical aspects of it. So yes, of course, the virtue of chastity is all very important, but why not make a prayer, for instance, like, there will be a time when someone else will gird you and will lead you to where you don't want to go. So make this a prayer of obedience, for instance, submission to God's will. And then, of course, you can also connect that with chastity and everything, but that's a dedication to God. But put the emphasis on what it's for, like the purpose, and make that more, I don't know, tie it more to the gospel and to... I don't know. Maybe it's just because stylistically it was all kind of, it felt a little bit too fiddly, too old-fashioned. And maybe it also triggered some of my aversion that I had from Rome, seeing some of these priests being overly focused on nice clothes. And so this priest in the video is showing off all the different albs, and then he had these very expensive ones. So if there is this one, you know, big celebration or this solemnity, I will wear this one because it's very valuable and very, like, oh, come on, please. No, no, this is not what we need right now. So anyway, I'm not against beautiful liturgy, don't get me wrong. I'm also I'm not a fan of the reforms in the 70s where everything had to be like as ugly as possible. I like beautiful churches, even liturgical clothes. But I would say innovate instead of doing just the retro stuff. But anyway, it made me think, you know, I have to spend some more time kind of studying these older rituals and see if I can come up with, at least for myself, for like personal devotion, come up with equivalents to that, but that are more fitting for these times. Because I think there's something nice about it, the whole ritual in the sacristy being also part of the liturgy. Right now, the sacristy is kind of a gathering place for people that are like doing last minute adjustments so what's going to be the opening song? Did we already prepare the frankincense, etc.? So everybody is like talking, and it's a very business-like atmosphere, and I think we've lost something there. I think it should be. After all, we're going to pray, we're going to celebrate the sacred mysteries. You know, you should, when you go to a restaurant, like a Michelin star restaurant, you dress up, right? You get into the mood. It's part of the ritual. And I think maybe in our current Catholic practice, we have lost kind of that sense of not just preparing yourself with vestments or you know, knowing which text I'm going to read, but also preparing yourself spiritually. I think there's absolutely something to rediscover. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. And with that, it is time to start to wrap things up. I need to go to bed and I'll upload this as soon as I can. I just want to give you a tip. If you have seen me play Battlefront 2, the Star Wars game, which is awesome, it's going to be free next week on the Epic Store. Completely free. And it has a single-player campaign, so it's not just getting shot by online stormtroopers. This has a fantastic Star Wars story. So even if you only play the single player campaign, it is absolutely worth your time. And again, it's going to be free. Just go to the Epic Store and install their it's like Steam. They have like an app on your computer, and then you have about a week, I think, to register that game. They will be giving away games for free every week. It's not always very good, but sometimes they have these fantastic games. I paid $20 for that game, and that was already a bargain. But free, absolutely don't miss it. All right, talk to you guys later. Thanks for being a patron.